Newsrooms struggle to communicate climate data. Some worry about being too alarmist. Others worry about communicating the data clearly. One American newspaper has a column devoted to breaking down climate data, and that's the focus of this episode of Stats and Stories, where we explore the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. I'm Rosemary Pennington. Stats and Stories is a production of Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film, as well as the American Statistical Association. Joining me is regular panelist John Baylor, Emeritus Professor of Statistics at Miami University. Our guest today is a return visitor, Harry Stevens. Stevens is the Climate Lab columnist at the Washington Post. He was part of a team at the Post that won the 2020 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for the series 2C Beyond the Limit. Stevens came to the Post from Axios, where he designed news graphics and worked on data-driven investigations. Stevens' journalism career has also included stints at the Hindustan Times in New Delhi, India, and the Salt Lake Tribune in Utah. He's here today to talk about the work he's done for the Climate Lab. Harry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to see you guys again.
What is the Climate Lab and how did it get started?
So I got to admit that the naming might be a little confusing because the Climate Lab just refers to a team of visual journalists embedded in the climate department at the Washington Post. So I think there are six of us now, and most of the team works on longer investigations that are more ambitious in scope. So stories that might take, you know, months to report, original data collecting, and they end up producing these really incredible, beautiful stories. There was one series last year on the sort of whether the Anthropocene is a sort of an appropriate way to think about the era that we're living in. And then there's me. And my work is a bit, is much faster. I was going to say quick and dirty. I don't think it's dirty, but it's a lot faster. So my column comes out every 2 weeks, and I'm doing everything from, you know, finding the story, analyzing the data, creating the graphics, interviewing sources, and writing the story. So, you know, you can imagine that, you know, in 2 weeks, your time ends up getting filled up doing all that stuff. And so, you know, every 2 weeks, I try to look at some aspect of climate change or the environment that's new and interesting and kind of touches on the news and what's happening in the world.
So I just want to start with saying, Rosemary just asked a two-part question and always yells at me for asking two-part questions. So I just wanted to have this on
Nobody's
record
perfect.
That you
Nobody's
did
perfect.
That you too will yield to that temptation. So Harry, that's great. I love hearing kind of this you kind of outlined a bit of the workflow. You know, this finding the story, finding the data, analyzing the data, integrating, synthesizing, and then presenting it in story form. I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about maybe one or two of the stories that you shared with us. I mean, I really enjoyed the mix of both the images, like the bird population declining piece, as well as some of the analyses that are being done. And maps are clearly one of the go-tos for telling the story of spatial change, but then the graphics and some of the temporal change. And so can you talk a little bit about where did that bird population change story come from? What inspired you?
So that story came from something called eBird. And eBird is a project mostly of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And so they have for the last two decades or so been crowdsourcing bird observations from people on the internet. So it's kind of like Wikipedia, but for bird observations. And over time, the number of people submitting observations has increased dramatically to the point now where, you know, over the last 10 years or so, they can have representative data of bird observations across, you know, maybe the whole world, but certainly like the United States and other countries where they have a lot of eBird users. And so, you know, the data set itself is incredibly rich and valuable, you know, something that really could not have existed without the internet. You know, people have been, you know, really probably for thousands of years, for as long as there have been people, they've been going outside and noticing the birds and maybe even making systematic observations about the birds that are around them. You know, people are just interested in birds. But it wasn't until the internet that we were actually able to aggregate all of those observations and, you know, do some statistics on them to, you know, be able to track trends over time and things like that. So they have this database, which I was unaware of until eBird published this mapping tool. And you can go to their website and check it out. It's really well designed. And that's what drew me to it, because I'm, you know, sort of a designer along with a journalist. So whenever I see a cool internet, you know, data visualization tool, I get excited about it. And so I was exploring it. Turned out they had an amazing API, so I could just download the data and make my own maps. And so, you know, then I was kind of off to the races. Like, it was kind of backwards, you know, like I started with, hey, this is going to be a cool looking presentation. And then I had to, you know, interview bird experts basically to figure out what was interesting about the data, what kind of trends were significant.
Well, what was interesting? What did your analysis find?
So, I mean, the big fact about North America's bird population, which if you're familiar at all with the situation of birds in North America, you're familiar with, but otherwise you probably don't know, is that in the last 50 years, North America has lost 3 billion breeding adults, which amounts to about 30% of the population of birds. And that trend has not been arrested. It's continuing. And so, you know, a natural question to ask is, what is going on with North America's birds? So the eBird data doesn't cover that long of a time period. Obviously, the internet hasn't existed for that long, but they do have enough data that they can give you trends on the last 10 years. And so that was sort of good enough to be able to, you know, as a window into this problem of bird population decline. And, you know, scientists are always careful about assigning causation to any kind of trend. The biggest one for birds, though, is certainly habitat destruction, you know, more so than climate change. And a lot of environmental issues are like this, actually. You know, like, you know, climate change is this long-term, you know, looming trend that can have sort of systemic negative issues over time. But just like destroying animals' habitats is also very bad for the animals. And that's what has happened to a lot of bird species. I mean, you look at sort of grassland birds, things like bobolinks that nest in these tall grasses in the American prairie. And basically, like, all of American grasslands have been, or not all, but a majority of American grasslands have been converted into agriculture and into towns and cities. And so that's been pretty devastating for a lot of the bird population there. And so we sort of went through, like, you know, some of the interesting species, and we looked at species who, you know, have had positive trends, who are doing rather well. So, you know, species like blue jays, for example. If you have a backyard bird feeder, you probably see the blue jays out there, because they do really well at bird feeders. They're very aggressive. They eat anything. And so for them, like, you know, the rise of suburbs has actually been really good. So, you know, anytime you have a large environmental change, you know, some species are going to do poorly and others are going to do well. And so it just sort of explored all of these trends in bird data. And then, you know, the thing that we do with Climate Lab is we like to personalize it. So we made it so that you can go in, type in your town where you live, and it'll give you, you know, the most abundant birds there and what their trends are. And then you can also search for any, or not any bird species, but I think about 500 bird species, common bird species in the United States, and see, you know, a geospatial trend of, like, where they've become more common, where they've become less common.
Yeah, I did that this morning. You know, I did research by looking out at the birds that are my bird feeder, and I started thinking about how rare, unusual these sightings were. And I was glad to see a goldfinch, and I was also glad to see a bluebirds. But I was kind of surprised as the story started to see some of the images of birds that you all started with in this story included, you know, kind of grackles and crows, which are not always celebrated as bird sightings. So I thought it was really, how did you decide on how to frame this in terms of bringing in a reader about what images, what birds did you choose to kind of feature, to kind of catch the eye?
So the first thing about those images is that, that's another thing about eBird, is that they have these beautiful illustrations of the birds on their website. And so I just asked them, like, hey, could we use 10 of these? And then they got permission from Birds of the World, which I think has the rights to those images. And so that really made the article a lot more beautiful to have these illustrations of the birds. So choosing them, I wanted to talk about some specific biomes. So I mentioned like the grasslands and the bobolink. And then there's a canyon wren at the top. And so that was illustrative of the arid lands biome down in the Southwest, where climate change actually has had a somewhat significant impact on the populations there because birds already live pretty close to their physiological limit. And so additional drought or additional heat can actually be a fairly negative factor. And then we also wanted to emphasize that like this isn't just, you know, species that are adapted to specific biomes that you might not see that often. Like if you can search for, you know, really common species of birds, like you mentioned goldfinch or the American crow, you'll also see that their populations are declining across, you know, a huge swath of the country. So I wanted to kind of emphasize that this is like an issue affecting, you know, birds that are in your backyard.
So the first day of spring is not far from today and as we're recording. And there's another story. I mean, we were looking at all of these stories you've been working on about spring. So like my mother is continually saying, I think it's getting warmer. Winter is not very long and spring is coming sooner. And, you know, she's a gardener. So she's always very concerned about sort of when she can get outside. And I love the headline of this. You're not crazy. Spring is getting earlier. So could you talk us through sort of how you came up with the idea for this story and how you sourced data for it and what you crunched?
For sure. Yeah. So I have the same experience talking to people. Like people have a lot of anecdotal evidence of climate change. And it's, you know, scientifically, like it's not really that useful, except that so many people seem to have these same experiences, particularly people who are, you know, a bit older and have lived in the same place for long enough to notice a change. And I was thinking about it, it's like kind of interesting that for the vast majority of human history, like if you wanted to know what the weather used to be like, you had to talk to somebody who's older than you. Like we didn't have systematic observations of the temperature over time. And of course now we do, but so it was sort of like hearkening back to that. Like I talked to a bunch of Washington Post readers in their 60s and 70s who had lived in the same place for a long time and just about how spring had changed near them, you know. So like one example was a guy told me I was going to MIT in the 1970s. When I went to my final exams in May, I always saw the magnolias blooming. And now I still live in Boston and the magnolias are blooming in April. So just stuff like that. And so that to me by itself is interesting. But again, as I said, it's not really like scientifically valid. And so I wanted to see like how well people's observations of the world around them matched up with the data. And so there's something called the USA National Phenology Network. Phenology is this word, fancy word for the study of the change of seasons. And so they have a index called the First Leaf Index. They also have a First Bloom Index. And that is supposed to represent the start of biological spring across the country. So it's a gridded data set, and I don't want to get too into the weeds of like how they produce it. Suffice it to say that like it's not they don't force people to like sit in one place day and night, like vigilantly watch the trees, waiting for a leaf to come out, and then they write it down. It's sort of based on the temperature. They have this concept of accumulated growing degree days. They have this gridded data set, 4 kilometers square of when the first leaf was likely to have appeared every year, going back to 1981. And so what I did was I just downloaded the annual gridded data going back to 1981 of when the first leaf appeared in each 4 kilometer square grid cell. And then I just calculated a linear regression on each of those grid cells. And so, you know, you can see where spring has been trending earlier and where spring has been trending later. You know, and I filtered out some of the cells where like there was really no correlation at all between time and the arrival of spring. But even after that, you see this like vast swath of the country that goes all along the east and then all through the south and then up the west coast, almost, you know, up to the northwest, where spring is trending earlier. And then a little bit in the Midwest, where spring has been trending a bit later, but the area of land in which spring is trending earlier is about four times the size of the area of land where spring is trending later. And so, you know, that's just another signal that, like, as global warming nudges temperatures higher, springs will in fact be arriving earlier, and they do correspond to people's personal experiences of how spring has changed where they live. And just, you know, something I was thinking about while I was working on this story is, like, you mentioned, you know, how not to be alarmist about climate change. And I think that, like, a lot of people's experiences of climate change, it doesn't feel like, ah, Chicken Little, the sky's falling. It's just like, I remember how things used to be, and they're not like that anymore. Like, clearly something seems to be changing. And if you can, you know, find a data set that will capture that feeling that, like, something feels like it's changing, and just, you know, not try to freak people out about it, but just show them that this is what the data say, then, you know, I think it can make you feel less crazy. And I think it can, you know, illuminate how the climate is changing.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and today we're talking data and climate with Washington Post's Harry Stevens.
Yeah, so much of the stories that you're telling have these spatial and temporal components to them. And this idea of climate change, in particular how it's spatially it's affecting, I thought the story on trees moving north from global warming mm-hmm. was an interesting piece. And I sort of, in the same spirit of the last segment and the conversation about kind of growing and when you're doing your gardening, and now you're starting to think about what even you might be able to grow, that now all of a sudden things might be possible or not possible as a consequence. So can you give kind of a little recap and how you got into that story?
Sure. So, yeah, the thing about planting a tree that's unlike planting some other types of plants is that you're sort of like giving birth to a child, right? You're bringing life to something that is going to outlive you. You know, trees can theoretically live forever. You know, I think eventually every tree dies because of some kind of, you know, environmental change, or because somebody knocks it down or whatever, gets infected with a disease. But trees can really live a very, very long time. And so when you plant a tree, you want to know, is the growing environment appropriate for it now? But you also want to know, is the growing environment going to be appropriate for it in 50 years or 100 years or 150 years? And so, you know, when you're planting a tree in a relatively stable climate, that question's a bit easier to answer. But because the climate is changing, it, you know, becomes a little bit harder to answer. And so the USDA has this notion of a plant hardiness zone, which is just you know, an area of land in which, you know, certain types of plants are suitable to grow. So that's also derived from temperature. A lot of data sets are kind of derived from temperature. And so you can project how temperature is likely to change under a sort of moderate warming scenario. That's what I used. It's called RCP 4.5 for the climate nerds out there. And then so you can show how those plant hardiness zones will gradually shift north as temperatures increase. And so that can guide you in what sorts of trees you might want to plant. And so I talked to, you know, horticulturalists, people who work at botanical gardens, about how they're thinking about this. And again, like, when you talk to people who deal with this stuff on a daily basis, you know, they're already thinking about it, even if they're not doing the, you know, super hard science of, you know, making a map to show the whole country. So, you know, at the New York Botanical Garden, for example, they're planting southern magnolias, you know, thinking of a future in which New York is a much more suitable climate for that tree.
You have in all of your columns, or at least all that I've been able to look at, with the, you know, caveat that I don't know that I've read all of your columns, but I've read a lot of them. There's always this little spot where you sort of write what's at stake, and you break down kind of key takeaways. Why are you including that in your columns?
I think it's a useful reader service for people to just get a quick takeaway of, you know, what's happening. I think journalists call it a nut graph. So it's basically like putting the nut graph into its own little section with bullet points Like, this is the big context for this story. Like, this is why it matters. You know, so I've kind of been doing the nut graph with each article that I've been talking about. But like, so for the tree one, it's that, you know, trees can adapt to changes in climate, but current climate change is much faster than historical climate changes. And so that makes it more difficult for trees to adapt. So just kind of like giving people the big takeaway.
I think that's really effective. I mean, I find that it's for me, it really draws me in and then makes me want to revisit the story as well, just to see how those ideas were supported. And I particularly like the component where you let me look where I live. You know, the idea of being able to enter a collection of cities really, really helps bring me in as a reader. So I want to say, you know, two thumbs up on that aspect. That's really.
Yeah. Well, let me just talk about that for a second, too, because there's been sort of a debate in the visual journalism world about how much readers use interactive components of graphics. You know, like, you spend all this time making something that's interactive. Do people actually use the interactive element? And so there was, you know, some talk years ago that, like, you know, you're spending too much time on your interactive components. People aren't really using them. But I think that a lot of times what the sort of anti-interactivity crowd was talking about was like these sort of subtle types of interactions, like you know, hover over dot in a scatter plot and you see a tooltip come up that gives you the information about that dot. And it wasn't really well labeled on the chart, like, definitely you can hover on this dot and get a tip. And so people weren't really using them. And the data showed that people weren't really using them. And from that, a lot of people concluded that, you know, it wasn't worth making these interactive elements. And what I got from that instead was like, no, just make really useful interactive elements. You know, make something where people get a huge and valuable takeaway from it. And so one of the types of interactive elements that's really valuable is these personalization elements, where you can look up your town and get the localized data for where you live. And then once you look up your town, you're naturally going to start thinking about other towns, like, oh, what's New York like? Or what's Salt Lake City like? I used to live in Salt Lake City. So, you know, you start naturally comparing other places. And so we track user interactions on all of our interactive components. And so we get very, very high usage rates on components like that. You know, sometimes more than 50% of our readers will look up where they live. Whereas like the more subtle ones, which I also like to do, just as somebody who likes to design nice graphics, like I put in tooltips and stuff, but it's true, like people don't use those ones as much.
I just, as a, you know, a case of one, I teach a lot of Washington Post articles in my journalism classes, and because I teach multimedia journalism, and it's often these big interactive things. And my students are always like typing in, wanting to see like what's going on in or around Oxford or where their hometowns are. So like that, mm-hmm. that personalization for those guys is like key. Like that will draw them into that story so hard and so fast. It's kind of amazing to watch.
Yeah. And another tip on that one is, so there's different sort of administrative units that you can use to let people look up. And so sometimes you'll see like zip code, for example. I don't really use zip code. And the reason is that, yes, you know your own zip code, but you don't know the zip code of San Antonio or Seattle or Los Angeles. And in fact, you don't even know the county most of the time. And so I also don't use county. I like to use the actual town name. And so like what you can do to create those data sets is, if you have a gridded data set, you can also have a list of cities by their latitude and longitude, and then you can just join the list of cities to the grid. And that lets people not only look up their own city, but also, you know, explore and compare, which is a lot of fun.
So I was just, you know, one of the things I was playing with the tooltips was I taught a data visualization class for many years, and I always loved that. But at times it wasn't clear, I think, to people that were interacting with the plot that it was even available to them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the challenges with that type of display. But in the story that you did, both heat and cold can kill, but cold is far more deadly. And so within that story, there was a really nice, I think, tooltip display where you could look at what your country might might look like. And so while you could look up your country, then immediately it showed with the tooltip information, including mortality change and temperature and GDP per capita, so all that other information. So it was this kind of nice interplay in looking at kind of the information from a query, from your country query, to then being able to start playing with some of the other tooltips that might exist. So I thought that was I still like them too. So don't give up, Harry. Harry, keep up the good fight.
But I'll tell you, like on that, I can't remember the exact numbers, but I think so. There's also a spinny globe where you can spin it around, and that's like I think a even higher value interaction. And so you know we had. I don't want to give the exact numbers because it'll be wrong, but way more people spinning the globe than doing the tooltip on the scatter plot. And I like this tooltip on the scatter plot. It's just, it's not as popular.
Yeah. I wonder, how do you decide what visualizations you're going to use? Because I was looking at the fishing one and then there's the map that sort of tracks my computer died during our conversation, but it was tracking, I think, some route or something as you were scrolling, which I thought was so interesting to kind of see. How do you decide, like, you know, and then the illustrations of the birds and the bird story, what visualizations you're going to use beyond sort of like a scatter plot or something, but how do you think about those other more creative things and how do you decide what you're going to use in your story?
I think it's good if every story has some kind of big wow graphic to draw people in and let them know. I like to have it up at the top to let people know, like, this is not a typical article. Like, this is something special. You're going to, you know, get a lot out of it if you take the time to, you know, look at all the graphics. That's why we make like crazy cool graphics, like to try to make something that's interesting instead of just a typical plot. It's hard to decide like what will be the visual for any particular story. I guess it's just like, you know, try to bring out the pattern in the data in a interesting and useful and beautiful way. And I don't know. I guess it depends on the data set.
Yeah.
So I'm curious. You've been doing this now for quite a while, and I've really appreciated. You know, I really got turned on to some of your work when you were doing the COVID billiard balls. You know, sort of about flattening the curve. That to me was incredibly effective. And as you know, we included that as part of a chapter in a book that we wrote. This part of the reflections on that.
Thank you for that, by the way.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thank you for the work that helped connect us to that. I'm curious about how has working on the climate lab and all of these stories. I mean, every 2 weeks, these are devastating stories in terms of life on planet Earth. And and so in doing this, how has your thinking changed as a consequence of working on the sequence of stories related to climate change and its impact?
I would say that my concern has shifted from being worried about what's going to happen to humans to being worried about what's going to happen to all the other animals and plants. And that's not to say that like climate change won't have negative consequences for human civilization, like particularly coastal societies. If there's, you know, significant sea level rise, that will be very disruptive. And, you know, agricultural systems will likely have to shift some. So I'm not dismissing the difficulties that humans will have adapting to climate change, but humans will be able to adapt to climate change. I guess I don't want to say that completely 100% sure that humans will be able to adapt to climate change, but we're a very adaptable species. Like, we live in all kinds of climates. You know, we can live in Greenland and we can live at the equator and do pretty well in all sorts of environments, and we can plan. We know that climate change is happening, and so we can plan for, you know, 20 years, 50 years, 100 years into the future. So that's not to say that it will be easy to adapt or it'll be cheap to adapt, but it's possible for us. Whereas for a lot of nature, like, they just don't have any of the advantages that we have there. I mean, if you look at something like, you know, coral reefs, like, they're not able to move physically. They're not able to understand what's happening around them. And they're very sensitive to temperature changes. And so, you know, when the ocean temperature increases, coral reefs basically can't do anything. And so, yeah, I think that when you listen to, like, certainly environmental activist groups that are trying to raise money for various climate related causes, you know, they tend to emphasize the danger to human beings, because I think that humans are naturally more interested and concerned with what's going to happen to us. But I think truly, like, the threat is to the rest of nature more so than to humans.
Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Harry, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you, Harry.
Thanks for having me, guys. This was really fun.
Stats and Stories is a partnership between Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film, as well as the American Statistical Association. You can follow us on Twitter at Stats and Stories, Apple Podcasts, or other places where you find podcasts. If you'd like to share your thoughts on the program, send us an email at statsandstories@miamioh.edu, or check us out at statsandstories.net. And be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.